This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today we're going to talk to somebody who is a legendary figure in my own life. Hank Wesselman is a research paleoanthropologist, but that's just the beginning of this remarkable man. He is a shamanic teacher of the very first order. He has 30 years of experience, and I don't mean experience in the study of shamanism. We are talking to a real shaman who comes out of the Western world. He was born in New York City. He lives in Hawaii, but what a journey of life there has been between those two places. Hank, thank you for coming to Dreamland and welcome.
Well, Whitley, it's an honor. You know, I lived on your books way back when, and, you know, it's just a thrill to be talking to you.
Well, I'm glad it's mutual, because sometimes sometimes it isn't. Hank, Judith, well, let me fill out a little bit more, folks, before we get started. Judith Orloff said a rather wonderful thing about Hank and about the book we're going to be sort of building the interview around. But the beauty of this interview is you can engage directly with Hank because he's working on something very extraordinary, and you can actually get involved with him in a way that in just a few years ago wasn't even possible. Anyway, she says the reenchantment is full of magic, insight, and profound realizations about the nature and spirit of life. She describes you as a master teacher of shamanism, and that I think is the truth. Now, what I want to do is to start in a funny place. We're going to go all over this story over the course of our time together, Hank and I are, but I want to talk to begin with an extraordinary encounter you had at 4 o'clock one morning that led you into what I think is a very critically important insight about the way our world works, especially in the spirit. Could you describe that moment in the reenchantment that you talk about called the Pagan Christ?
The Pagan Christ. You know, this is a very interesting book that was written by Tom Harper, who's I think he's an Anglican priest in Canada. And what he revealed in that book was that the Egyptian god Horus was actually the Pagan Christ. Horus had a different name 4,000 years ago. He had a nickname, Eusa, and his mother, Isis, had a nickname, Mary. And Mary in Egyptian means beloved. So Mary and Eusa, does this sound familiar? Well, yes. you know, 2,000 years later, the early Christians sort of co-opted this myth from the past, and they created a Messiah, a living expression of Yahweh. All right, that sort of big guy who's kind of like Donald Trump. And in Canaanite culture, Yahweh was actually a Canaanite god, a thunder god, kind of like Zeus, and he hated trees. And he commanded his followers to cut down the sacred groves of the pagans, of course. And he, you know, as the way in which Jung, the psychologist Carl Jung, talks about him, as he said, you know, whoever has a relationship with God affects God, because God is a creation that we created. And so Yahweh is kind of like this individual who has good days and bad days. He's motivated by a violent power drive, unlike anybody we know in Washington. And, you know, he is kind of like a primitive chieftain, aggrandized to colossal size. This is the source of the monotheistic creator God of the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. And the interesting thing about Yahweh is that he is not a real God. He's not a real spirit. He's a thought form that was beings. But when you've got billions of people believing in a thought form like this, what it does is it empowers the thought form, and the thought form feeds on the attention, the energy that it gets from its believers. So although very few people talk about Zeus and Athena these days, although some do, you know, they were also thought forms, which are called sometimes egregores. This is something I wrote about in the Reenchantment, about the masters of deception and how some of these ancient deities are real deities and then some of them are not. Like, I personally believe that Isis is a real deity. I believe that Horus is a real deity. I believe that Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess, you know, is a real deity. And whenever I go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, there are several statues of Sekhmet in black diorite stone. And I always make offerings and prayers, and that's part of my job. I'll wait until the guards are distracted, and then I'll take a crow bead from the American Indians, a red one usually, and I'll select a space and just sort of tuck it in and a crack, you know, leaving my aloha with it. And so, you know, these deities that people encounter and believe in and have relationships with, some of them are real and some of them are not. Is this the one that you wanted to talk about?
Well, yes, and you were talking about it very well, so you don't need to backtrack and ask me. What if I had said, "Oh, no, that's not what I want to talk about." No, it very definitely is. And what I want to talk about now, as we move along, and we got a long way to go. We got plenty of time. I want to talk about the difference between a thought form and a god. And I want you to explain first how you feel a thought form is created.
Well, a thought form is created in the minds of those who choose to believe in it. For example, you can have egregores, which are called epa in Hawaiian, or the archons of the Gnostics, or the Wetiko of the Cree Indians of the North. You know, these are beings who are not evil, but they encourage the people that they infect to go ever deeper into the negative polarity until they reach a threshold. And if they step across that threshold, they can no longer self-correct. And it has been theorized by individuals like Paul Levy, who lives in Portland, who wrote a book called Dispelling Wetiko.
Yes, we've interviewed him on this show.
Oh, I know him. I've met him.
He's a really remarkable man.
Book. It's a little overwritten, in my opinion, Whitley. You know, I would have preferred the book to be half its length.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, the information is there, and it's very valuable.
Yeah.
So, folks, just if you want to listen to that interview, go to the search engine and search on Wetiko, Wetiko.
Yeah.
Well, so go ahead.
Not actual spirits. And the American Indians have been tracking them as archetypes of evil for centuries. The book, the film that didn't do very well on the Lone Ranger.
Yeah, a Johnny Depp film.
You know, one of the reasons at the beginning of the film he'd been thrown into jail because they caught him. And what he was actually doing was he was tracking the Wetiko. That was one of those things they just slipped in there. And, you know, it revealed that somebody in Hollywood knows about this. That's good news. Because what these psychic entities do, and I might say that in the psychic world and the spirit world are not the same. The Kahuna mystics of Hawaii would consider the psychic world to be level two, the same level as thoughts, emotions, feelings, and energy. And level one would be the physical realm, and then level three would actually be the dream time, the dream world. So these egregores, these thought forms, do not live in the dream world. They're not spirits. But what they are kind of like mind parasites that reside in the minds of those that they choose to infect. And they operate by psychic stealth, which is why most people are completely unaware of the fact that they're infected by a negative energy, which is encouraging them to act out in negative ways. If you were to look at the current resident of the Oval Office in Washington, without going political, he's a classic Wetiko. He cannot control what comes out of his mouth. Somebody else is running the show.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe nobody's running that show. It's hard to know what's going on there. But I really don't want to go down that path too much because it's not this isn't a political show, and it pushes so many buttons that people start not listening anymore to you. You lose track of your message.
Right.
But I agree with you. There's obviously something is off there, and I think that what happened here is that the pressure of this office overwhelmed a man who wasn't prepared to cope with it, essentially. And now you've got a vacuum where we urgently need leadership. Okay.
Yeah, that says it very well.
Well, thank you. But the spelling Wetiko and finding Wetiko inside ourselves is something that is hard to do. And for example, when you look at your own life, and any one of us does, or I do, where do we look to find Wetiko? You said it was stealthy. What is the, where are we going? Because in Tonto, in the first part of the movie, of the latest Lone Ranger movie, is looking for Wetiko outside of himself.
That's right. He's tracking it. He's essentially a medicine man, and he's tracking the archetype of evil. Excuse me. And I found that amazing because I went to see that film, and I wasn't quite prepared, and I don't think the film really succeeded. But that little inset, you know, got my attention because somebody obviously knows. But, you know, these negative thought forms, and I've often wondered about the people that you call the grays, all right? The small alien-type people with big heads and almond-shaped dark eyes.
Yes.
And then there are the tall ones. You know, I have had students in my shamanic workshops who actually have connected with them. There's a woman named Angela Thompson Smith, who wrote a book called Voices of the Cosmos. And they actually are a series of interviews with various extraterrestrial beings, including the grays and the tall ones. You know, and, you know, I find this information very compelling. I don't know if I've ever had any connection with them between us, you know, even, you know, in my shamanist profession. But I'll tell you a little story since we got a little time. When this book Spirit Walker came out, it made quite an impression. That was my first book. And it's really about how I, as a professional scientist, began to have these altered state experiences in which my mind was drawn into connection with the mind of another man.
Just hold on a moment. We have to take a break here,
okay,
just very briefly, and then we're going to go back. Free Dreamlanders, you know what to do. We'll be right back.
Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
I want to tell you a little bit about my book, The Path. It came to me very suddenly one day in the mid-70s, before I had had any close encounter experiences or was even very much aware of any of this. I was in the Gurdjieff Foundation at the time, and I was fooling around with a deck of tarot cards, and suddenly this remarkable path emerged, and I understood the cards deeply. I grabbed on to the idea and put it down on paper. I'm actually holding the paper I put it down on in my hands right now, now an old yellow piece of typing paper with notations all over it. And it eventually became the path, a lay of the tarot cards that shows the path of life. And it's in the little book, The Path. It's now available as an ebook. You can go and get it on Streber.com or on Amazon.com. Just search on The Path, Streber, and it'll come up, or anywhere ebooks are sold. It's $3.99. And if you do get it and you have any questions, please write me at Whitley@Streber.com, and I'll be glad to engage with your questions as best I can. As time goes on, I begin to see The Path more and more as a really important contribution in my body of work. It's not about using the cards for divination exactly. It's more about using the cards to understand in a very deep way how to live the path of life. It's something that more and more I find myself going back to. There's a lot of value there, I feel. So, go take a look at Streber.com, The Path.
All of my summer conferences have been canceled except one, Consciousness and Contact, the last weekend in July on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, the site of the extraordinary experience I had last summer that I describe in A New World of Seeing into a Parallel Universe. We'll be back. We're going to do a CE5 experiment at the Devil's Tower. That's attempting to call and get into contact with the visitors as a group. Linda Moulton Howe is going to be there. Barbara Lamb and many others. It's going to, without question, be an extraordinary conference. But there's a kicker. The kicker is there are only 35 guests. We have 10 speakers and 35 attendees. That is it. So if you want to go, go to unknowncountry.com right now and click on the Consciousness and Contact ad, or email mia.feroleto@gmail.com. That's Mia, M-I-A, dot Feroleto, F-E-R-O-L-E-T-O, @gmail.com to find out more. We're talking to Hank Wesselman. His book, The Reenchantment, his website, sharedwisdom.com, where you can find all of his books, and you can also get involved directly with him. He has workshops, and he has audio programs. There's a lot there. And there is also a way to get access to shamanic healing. Now, before we left the air, Hank was just about to tell us about a connection with a certain man's mind. Hank, can you continue for us?
Well, the interesting thing is that I was living in Kona at that time, and I began to have these experiences, usually at about 4 o'clock in the morning, where my body would stiffen and become completely paralyzed. I'd be invaded by these feelings of power or force that could have been quite disturbing, but they were actually, incredibly joyful. it was like, you know, ecstasy took on a whole new word for me at that time. And they unraveled, they unfolded in a series that actually still goes on today, in which my mind and soul literally time traveled to a period that seems to be about 5,000 years after the collapse of Western civilization. This is a man who lives on the western coast of North America in a land profoundly different from the way it is today, and a life that's profoundly different as well. And when I connected with him for the first time, he was leaving his community around the edge of what he calls the Inland Sea, which is the central valley of California, filled with a marine inundation. He was leaving on a journey of geographic investigation of the interior of the lost continent of America. Now, for me as a scientist to come out and say that is really pretty radical. You know, most of my colleagues, my academic colleagues, my scientific colleagues, they would go to great lengths never to be associated with a book like this. You know, for those who don't know, I work in East Africa as part of the Fossil Man team. And so I've worked with the superstars of the academic community in search of answers to the mystery of human origins. And in addition to my scientific publications and monographs, suddenly this book, Spirit Walker, appeared. Well, you know, my colleagues went into a kind of shock. And what happened next was interesting. The book was published in 1995, and in 1996, I was connected with a brain scientist from the University of Illinois at Chicago. This is a man who was the head of the lab, the brain function lab, and he sent me a manila envelope. And when I got it, there were various reprints that fell out, as well as a cover letter. And he said, "Dear Dr. Wesselman," he said, "listen, I just read your book, Spirit Walker, and I think I know what you're doing. Can you tell me if you can essentially achieve these expanded states of awareness with intention?" So I look at his reprints, and there's a reprint in French. Fortunately, I can read French. And it's written by a scientist named Henri Gastaut. In the late 50s, at that time, Gastaut was the foremost investigator of temporal lobe epilepsy, and he was very interested in brain waves and expanded brain states. And so what he did is he went to India looking for somebody who could achieve very high frequency brain waves, and he found one. He found a guru who had an ashram and who was training his acolytes in Kundalini Yoga. So he had an EEG machine with him, his traveling device, and the Roshi, or the guru, decided to acquiesce, and he allowed Gastaut to do some brainwave work on him. And so while he was hooked up to the EEG machine, he expanded his conscious awareness, and Gastaut got it. And this was very interesting because, as most of your listeners know, the brain waves are in very particular frequencies. For example, when you're dreaming at night and you're asleep, your brain is functioning in firing impulses at roughly 1 to 3 impulses per second. Then there's a state called the theta wave. And they tend to fire impulses between 4 and 8 cycles per second. Then there are alpha waves, which are 8 to 13, and beta waves, which are roughly 13 to 20, 25. Beta waves happen when you're thinking, when you're focusing, when you're doing your work in the world, and they tend to be focused in the left half of the brain. Alpha waves are focused primarily in the right side of the brain, and it's kind of like a resting state. And people who meditate often go into alpha brainwave states. But that theta brainwave state between delta and alpha This is a brainwave state which has been measured in shamans and psychics and trance mediums and healers. And this guy, Norman Don, Dr. Norman Don, who connected me from the Brain Function Lab in Chicago, he said, you know, I've been working in Brazil for the last 8 years on an NIH grant with Gildo Moura, who is my compatriot, my assistant, my co-worker. And he said, we've been able to find people who can achieve these very high-frequency brainwave states. Now, high-frequency beta waves go up to about 20-25. What he discovered is there were the people who could go out to 40-50 hertz, that's cycles per second, and they would generate amplitude which could light up a light bulb with these brainwave states. This is what this guy Gusteau found in India. Now, the interesting thing, Whitley, is that the dozen or so people that Don found in Brazil had all had the alien abduction experience.
Huh, how interesting. It makes me wonder. Of course, I live with the visitors now. They're here a lot, and it's just life now. It's not, they're never here for very long, I'm not afraid of them. And I have many different levels of contact, not just with them, but with my wife and with many, many different types of consciousness. And this is a huge world. And we're, those of us who are injected into physical bodies we're just only partly in here anyway. You know, this is only, it's not an illusion, but it is a game, that's for sure.
Well, this leads me to ask, if when you have these connections, do you feel the physical paralysis? Do you feel this incredible soaring feeling?
No, I'm not at all. I'm very much physically as I am right now. When the grays show up, my main concern is how long will they stay, because it's only going to be a few seconds. And they pop in and pop out as if they're coming from another dimension or something.
That sounds right to me, by the way.
But
go on.
But I'm completely normal. I'm not in an altered state anymore at all. I'm not afraid. And it's all very jokey and fun, actually. To be honest with you, it's joyous. I have a wonderful relationship with whatever in the world they are.
Oh, it is a joyous experience.
Oh, definitely. It's really lots of fun. They do have a sense of humor. And fortunately, I suppose for me, they find me terribly funny. I find them funny now too. So it's not a bad experience at all. And I want to learn from them, but mostly I want to meditate with them, because that is really something. They are good at that. When you're sitting together and their spirit and your spirit link up in a meditative state, it is extraordinarily energizing.
Well, what this guy Norman Don in Chicago did is he asked me if I could access the state in which I go into these visionary journeys like the shaman. He asked me if I could do it voluntarily, and I said yes. So what he did is he came to Sacramento, where I was teaching college at that time, and he brought his EEG unit with him, and he set up a lab in his hotel room on his nickel and, you know, invited me to come down, and he hooked me up with the gel cap, the wires, you know, which you sort of drill into your scalp. It's a rather discomforting experience, but the 26... as I recall, 26 particular points which have been isolated by science, which give you maximum results on what happens when the brain lights up. And so he's standing behind me in the hotel room, and he's got a laptop, and he's got the software, and he's got everything set up, and it took me about an hour and a half to get wired up, and he's got the EEG machine on. And so he looks at me and he says, now listen, I'm going to get some brainwave data on you. And so he did. And he said, listen, I don't see any organic brain disease. I don't see any abnormalities. You've got an absolutely perfect brain. And I might add, I had an EEG on my brain. What do they call it when they put you in the machine and it vibrates? An MRI.
Yeah.
Had an MRI in my brain recently, and I've got a just regular-ass brain. You know, it's just a real brain. And so, nothing unusual. Anyway, he asks me if I could access the state. Now, I don't really know what I do, but what happens is I can form the intention, I suppose, with my ego, and then my subconscious, the soul of my body responds, and suddenly I'm just absolutely soaring with these incredible feelings, and I vibrate. When I first began to have these experiences, I would like become the human vibrator. I would lie on the floor, and I would just vibrate all over the room with these incredible intensities.
You know, there are people in this world who, when they vibrate like that, can turn into other forms entirely. I know some people like that who can literally become another entirely different form from human.
Well, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, and I'm not sure I know what I'm doing now. It's kind of like my body knows how to do it, and I believe that this is an ability that runs in my family. Because my father, who was a New York lawyer, had these extraordinary visionary experiences in which he was merged with a man from the past.
Fascinating.
I'm merged with a man who lives in the future.
In the future, yeah.
But, you know, my father never told me about this. I didn't learn about it until after he had died from a friend of mine who was the son of my father's best friend. And, you know, the whole story came out at that point. But, you know, I went into this state and I held it for about a minute or two. And then when I felt my head was going to blow off my body, I let it go. And I turned around and looked at him and said, did you get anything? And he looked at me and said, you can really do this, can't you? And I looked at him and I said, why would I say I could do it if I couldn't? He said, you'd be amazed. There are all sorts of people who believe they can do all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it doesn't show up. But here I was doing it with science. And then he asked me a very male question. He said, can you do it again? The guru in India could only do it twice. So I gave him a dozen. And in every single episode, my brain waves were going out to 50, 60 hertz with these very high amplitudes of energy that could light up light bulbs. And so he was just thrilled because I was the first person in North America who he found could do this. You know, he'd found a dozen in Brazil, and he was completely puzzled. Then came the question, have you ever had an alien abduction experience? Now, I had to say to him, well, you know, I don't really know, because I consider my encounters with spirits, these are non-ordinary beings. They're transformational forces or transpersonal forces. And I've often wondered if these so-called extraterrestrials could fall into that category of being actually transpersonal beings who, as you've put it, live in another dimension. And, you know, the fairy folk fall into this category.
Yes, they do.
The jinn of the Middle East fall into this category, and I've had connections with them. And so I said, I don't really know. So he takes the lab down, and he comes over to my house for lunch, and he looks at my wife, Jill, and he says, you know, you have a very unusual husband. And my wife sort of gives him this flat stare and says, you know, tell me something I don't already know, because she was partial to all of this, you know. Often these experiences would happen on the heels of a joyous marital encounter. Ta-da! You know, I remember my wife wincing whenever I would say that on the radio or television. But, you know, it's a known experience for me now. And so He said, I've often wondered if those of you who can make these connections could actually be prototypes for a new species of human. Well, I thought about this, because I'd never thought about that before. And, you know, I looked at him and said, well, what if we're archetypes of a kind of human that could do this in the past, and we're in the process of losing it? Because,
well, yeah,
you know, like Jane Fonda said, if you don't use it, you lose
it. You lose it. We have to take another brief break, and we will be right back with Hank Wesselman, The Re-Enchantment.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab to see our options.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting, and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. We're talking to Hank Wesselman, his website, sharedwisdom.com. You can get involved with Hank on his website. There are events. There is shamanic healing. There's audio. There are books. There's lots to do there. And obviously a very interesting fellow indeed. Now, Hank, I wonder, this is one of the things that always troubles me a bit about a story such as your brain is that it implies a kind of specialness, a kind of hereditary specialness that isolates you from others and means that you're something that other people cannot attain and cannot be. And to some extent, that's true. We're all different. But my experience of knowing so very many close encounter witnesses and some of them are just the most least shamanic people you can imagine, and yet who have very provable experiences. And I wonder, what do you think about that? Do you think that there is something available to everybody, or is this just for certain isolated individuals?
I think this is something we come into the world with. Whitley, you know, if I've got this right, and I believe that I do, there may be a program on our inner hard drive. I'm talking about our DNA. And when that program is double-clicked with the right mouse, it allows people to expand their consciousness dramatically. and expand it into dimensional levels, which we don't really have access to in our everyday waking state of consciousness. The first thing we discover is that these other dimensions are inhabited. They're inhabited by forces. I call them transpersonal forces because that's the way I experience them. But, you know, the traditional people call them spirits. And you've got lots of different kinds of spirits. But some of them are in relationship with us humans and want the best for us, and they're in service to us. And so what shamans usually do is they enter into relationship with these transpersonal forces, and then they're able to do various things, initially on behalf of themselves, and then increasingly on behalf of others. You know, years ago, I asked the anthropologist and shaman Michael Harner, who many of your listeners know of, a year or so ago. We were friends for about 30 years. We both came out of UC Berkeley. And I did some training with him, and he really helped to set my feet back on the path because I didn't have an elder, a wise tribal elder, to advise me or instruct me. And so he gave me just enough for me to be able to put this together. And what I've done since then is I've been running workshops at places like Esalen and Omega and other places around the country, even in Europe. And what I've discovered is that you can take non-tribal Western people, and without telling them what to see, you can give them a set of coordinates. And then using the drum played in a theta brainwave pattern, about 4 to 5 beats per second, you can send people off into the other world. And they have these experiences that would pass muster at any Aboriginal campfire. Now, as an anthropologist, you know, I knew about shamans, and I've known shamans personally in the second half of my life. So what I think is that there's actually a program. But, you know, like most programs, unless you bring it up and on screen, it's just there. It's like getting a new laptop. I got a new laptop recently because my old one crashed. And, you know, I have no idea what this machine can really do. But, you know, occasionally I'll open it up at 4 o'clock in the morning, usually, you know, because I'm slept out. And some program will come up on the screen, and I have no idea what it is. This is very much what it was like for me. So if I've got this right, and I believe I do, based on the workshops and transformational conferences that I've been to and encountered, you know, gazillions of people over the years, just like you, I believe that most of us can do this. Now, some of can't. You know, some are real mentalists, like the linguists.
They believe they can't, and so they can't.
That's it.
Yeah,
some exactly. Things have to be believed to be seen.
Right. Well, that gets us back to what we began the conversation with, which were these entities that are generated by the mind or by the spirit and become separate entities. And if you don't believe that can be, then you are going to become a victim of Wetiko in your own life. And because you're not acknowledging your true self and your true power.
That's true.
That block makes these people like that very weak and very dangerous to themselves because they become victims of their own ignored reality. I think.
Well, you know, I think that in relationship to this, that about 50% of us, at least the ones in my workshops, are really good at this. And about 80-90% can do it to some extent. And then there's some who just can't do it. And I think like in a genetic program, it's expressed variably in the population. if I could put it that way. Now, if I were to take the cross-section of the huge population, it might be that only about 5 to 10% of us fall into this category, because the people that come into my training sessions are already involved. They already can do it to some extent, and that's why they come.
Yeah, the first initiation is always the discovery of something unexpected that in the flow of one's life that makes you say, like, what happened to you in Africa? Just really right at the beginning with Atiko. In fact, tell us about Atiko, will you? And this is a long time ago when you were still involved in paleoanthropology, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. And I might add that I still am.
No. Oh,
you know,
good.
There's only one way you get out of this club.
Well, to join those who you study.
Yeah, well, I'm sitting on a mountain of data right now, so all of my colleagues are leaving me alone because they know if they attack me, I think of them as the paleo mafia because of the way in which they behave towards each other. They know they won't get my data, and they want my data. It's kind of like my data is a hostage.
Right.
Well, you know, I might sort of begin by saying that when I was a little boy in New York, I had the ability, but I had no idea what it was. And I remember going to the zoo one day with my au pair or my mother, and I saw this incredible creature in a cage. It was a leopard. And the most extraordinary creature I could possibly imagine. It was absolutely beautiful. And I was aware of the fact that inside this powerful creature pacing in its cell, there was a great will that was imprisoned. And so I'm studying this leopard, and suddenly it stops and it looks at me, and it stares directly into my eyes, and something happened. And the best way I can describe it is that suddenly the bars were no longer there, and the leopard and I found ourselves in a place of blueness. It was blue. And the leopard was just studying me very, very carefully. And then I can't remember what else happened. But the leopard became my imaginary friend, kind of like Calvin and Hobbes. Remember Calvin and Hobbes? Hobbes was a stuffed animal,
sure.
Actually, a tiger. But Calvin perceived him as real. Well, that's what my relationship with the leopard was like. And I often refer to him as the leopard man, because he would stand up on his back legs to mimic my bipedal stance. And it never quite worked, but he did his best. But, you know, he was my friend during my childhood, and nobody knew about him. And then when I was 11 or 12 and went through puberty, you know, everything changed. And I eventually ended up in college in the life sciences as a zoologist. That was my undergraduate and master's degree work. And it was when I was out in Africa with the expedition in the lower Omo Valley of southwestern Ethiopia, I would be out in a safari camp for 3 months. Now, it's one thing to go camping on Labor Day weekend and come home on Monday night and have a shave and a shower. When you're living in the desert, you know, these arid, whispering lands are haunted. And what we were doing is we were surveying and collecting the fossils of the animals that once lived there, roughly between 800,000 and 3 million years ago. And we were doing excavation, geology, archaeology, you know, about 50 people in the field. And I had three African men who worked with me. Two of them were Wakamba tribesmen from Kenya, and they were kind of on loan from the Leakey family. And then the third one was a Dasnich tribesman from that region whose name was Atiko. And I'd been told that Atiko was a shaman, that he was a crocodile whisperer, that he could swim across the Omo River, which is a big river draining the Ethiopian highlands, and was responsible for creating all of these fossils. And the crocodiles would leave him alone, or he could bless a certain place and people could bathe there safely, and nobody'd get eaten by crocodiles. And these crocodiles, I mean, some of these buggers were like 20 feet long. They were as big as dinosaurs. They were actually rather frightening.
Yeah, and that I would agree with that. There, go ahead.
Anyway, Otako was one of the men who worked with me. And although we couldn't speak a word of each other's language, you know, friendship has a language of its own. And he was able to anticipate what needed to be done and do it without me even asking him. So we would develop a very close relationship. And then there was one day in 1972 when I began to have this feeling that I was being watched by something. Now, that's a kind of creepy feeling, because there were leopards and lions and hyenas and buffalo, and all of these are dangerous animals. So when you're 100 yards from your Land Rover, you're kind of out in the open. So this feeling would come over me from time to time, and, you know, I sort of watched it carefully, and that would go away. Well, on this one particular day, it was really hot. It was like 115 degrees. And we all decided to go back to camp for lunch and do some cataloging for the afternoon, because it was just too hot to stay outside. And so the Wakambas were putting all the tools and the implements back in the back of the Land Rover. And suddenly this feeling just washed over me really strongly. And I remember looking up, dusting myself off, and Otako, the shaman, was looking at something off to my left with considerable intensity. And so I kind of slid my eyes in that direction. I saw something, and it was big, and it was about 6 feet off the ground. And as I turned and looked directly at it, it disappeared. It was as though whatever that was stepped through a tear in the fabric of the air, and then zipped it closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out, and then it was gone. You know, I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking to myself, Hank, it's time to go back to Nairobi for a beer. So I turned and I looked at Otako, and he was watching me with some intensity. And in that moment, I knew that he'd seen it, and he knew that I'd seen it. And I knew that he knew that I'd seen it. And so I asked him in Swahili, Otako, what was that? And he smiled, you know, and he pointed at exactly the place where I'd seen it and said a single word in Swahili, Shaitani. Shaitani is the word for spirit. And in those days, I worshipped solely at the altar of science, you know. I didn't believe in spirits. I didn't believe in the existence of a soul. And I was a regular-ass scientist working at the top of my field. And so, you know, I made cryptic notes to myself in my journal, and I kind of stashed it. But the thing that bothered me is that when this thing had disappeared in the air, I thought I saw spots. And they were like spots of light. Well, 10 years later...
Leopard spots?
I went back to Berkeley to finish my doctoral degree. And 10 years later, a friend of mine called me up and said, listen, there's an anthropologist coming to town. He's going to teach a workshop in shamanism. You're going to like him. His name is Michael Harner. Well, I'd never taken a workshop before. And I had a sort of minimal understanding of who shamans are and what they can do. And, you know, I was finishing my dissertation at that point, and so I was very busy. And spending the weekend with a bunch of flaky New Age people wasn't high on my list of priorities. But I went. There was something about that memory of what had happened in Africa that got me to that workshop. And I found it very interesting. I thought to myself, oh, I'm going to get all sorts of great material for lectures when I get out of grad school and so forth and so on. And then there came a time when we did an exercise in which we paired up with another person in the workshop who we didn't know. And so I found myself paired up with this very attractive, slender young woman with long, dark hair and intense eyes. And she agreed to work with me. And the goal of the exercise was to journey, like the shaman does, into the other world to find a helping spirit for your partner. Now, it just so happened that this woman was named Sandra Ingerman. And at that time, she was a grad student at the CIIS in San Francisco in counseling psychology. And I was a graduate student in anthropology at Berkeley. So we'd never met. We had no idea who each other were. But, you know, when the drumming started, there was Michael drumming away on his drum in the dark in a theta brainwave pattern. This is the floor of a high school gymnasium. And here's this beautiful woman lying next to me on the floor, and I'm feeling anxious. I'm thinking to myself, gosh, what if she doesn't find anything for me, you know? And I was going down that road when suddenly she sits up next to me and gives me this intense look. And then she leans over, and I remember her long hair drifting across my face. And she plants her hands and her mouth on my chest and starts blowing into my sternum. Then she sits me up and blows into the top of my head, and I felt something. It was like a goosebump moment. And then when the drumming came to closure, she sat across from me and described her journey into the other world. And she described going down to the lower world of the dreaming of nature and encountering a being who said it was one of my old friends and wanted to come back into relationship with me. And then she described the leopard man. And it was a shock moment because nobody knew about the leopard man. And I hadn't thought about the leopard man in probably 30 years. But there was absolutely no question that that's who came back into my life. And then, as you know, Woodley, my entire life changed dramatically.
Yes, that would be the moment. But go ahead and tell us why.
When you've got power in your corner, you know, these helping spirits are involved with human beings in a helpful way, those who are willing to do that. And they tend to provide us with three things: power, protection, and support. This has been my discovery in the work that I do with them. And shamans collect spirit helpers the way in which we collect possessions. You know, the more helpers you have, the more you can do, because they've all have qualities and abilities that distinguish them from each other. You know, there are animal spirits, there are plant spirits, there are ancestral spirits, there are elemental spirits. There are the higher organizing intelligences, for example, and those among them who are dedicated to being in service to humanity are usually labeled angels and sort of anthropomorphized as winged superhumans. That's not how I perceive them, by the way. I perceive them as light beings, as extraordinarily brilliant spheres of light with vast intelligence, vast compassion for those of us who are working here in ordinary reality. So this was really my inception into the shamanic tradition. And then, of course, shortly thereafter, I think it was probably the same year, the guys upstairs, I think of them as the guys upstairs, and maybe your grays and your extraterrestrials fall into this category as well. The guys upstairs, I think, got tired of waiting around for me to wake up to what I was really supposed to be doing with his life. So one night, I think it was in August, my wife and I had a joyous marital encounter at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And as I'm going back to sleep in bed, feeling very blissful indeed, suddenly, this feeling rushed into my body, and in an instant, I was as stiff as a stick of wood. I mean, my whole body, I couldn't close my hands. And this could have been quite disturbing if it wasn't so exquisitely pleasurable. And as I gasped, trying to breathe, my vision came up, and I found myself in this forest in the dark. It was like black on black, shadows upon shadows with these great trees all around me. And I discovered that I could move from here to somewhere else simply by intending it. And so I'm moving through this forest, wondering about the source of these terrific feelings that I'm feeling. And I suddenly looked up and I saw this incredible image of a tall humanoid form. I'd say it was probably about 50 feet tall. And there was a head and there were shoulders. And then it went all the way down to the ground with no arms or legs. It was like this huge monolithic being. And, you know, I looked at this and I thought to myself, is it possible that this is the source of what I'm feeling? And suddenly, this power just amped up in me. You know, I was just absolutely flying. And this being sort of picked me up off the ground and rotated me in space. And here I was, you know, and it was totally dark, totally black, like a huge silhouette. And it was like, it was curious about me. I felt this sense of curiosity. And the whole experience was presented to me as, here, let me show you something. And what are you going to do about it? You know, that's what came to me. Well, this experience eventually came to closure. And I was put back in my bed, in my body in bed. It was a classic out-of-the-body experience. And I looked over at my wife, and she was asleep. But the next day, you know, I told her about the entire episode. And she said, well, it sounds like something is trying to get in touch with you. Maybe the next time you see it, you should ask it questions like, why are you here? Well, for me, that was just a little over the line at that time. I was still involved in very high-powered science. But what happened later in my life helped me to understand that I had climbed the ladder of success in my chosen field, which was paleoanthropology. And I'd gotten to the top of the ladder, and I was working with the superstars of the scientific community in Africa. You know, grants from the National Science Foundation, the whole thing. But I realized in response to this dark monolithic being which I'd encountered that the ladder I'd climbed was leaning against the wrong wall. And I had to start all over again at the bottom of the other ladder, which was leaning against another wall. And I'm still trying to work my way up. You know, I consider myself an acolyte, a student. I don't consider myself a master of anything, although it was very nice of Judith Orloff to say I was a master teacher.
Well, I didn't say you were a master. I said you were a master teacher. There's a difference. My wife used to say that there are no masters here, and she was one of the great teachers I've ever known.
Yeah, I've always felt that we're all students.
Exactly.
Even the Dalai Lama says that he's just a humble monk. He never claims anything. And I usually don't either. But because I've been an academic teacher for about 40 years, I'm pretty good at it. And my wife and I have organized these workshops through Shared Wisdom, which we offer at various venues around the country. I might just add that, you know, we're in the process of a big launch right now, in which I am going to do a year-long program online, a weekly meeting for an hour with teachings, narrative, journey work, and then recap. And then after about five or six of these, we'll do a Q&A session, a live Q&A session. And then we'll go back for the next section. And I'm going to draw on my academic teaching. I used to teach a class called Magic, Witchcraft, and Religion, which was very popular. I'd sort of turn people inside out in the first 2 weeks and then fill them with all sorts of interesting esoteric information and then turn them right side in the last 2 weeks. And, you know, they would regard this as initiation. That was really a great compliment.
We have come to the end of our first hour. We will continue on, subscribers, with Hank
in our last half hour. We're going to go a good bit deeper. There are some secrets yet to be revealed and some extraordinary experiences to unfold. Hank's website is sharedwisdom.com. That's sharedwisdom.com. His book, The Re-Enchantment. Thank you very much for being with us. Subscribers, we'll keep right on keeping on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.